coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I feel like we've been on a whirlwind tour, Cole, of comicdom for the past week or two.
I've been putting you through your paces lately, that's for sure.
Yeah, but we're doing it. We're doing it. I'm excited about this issue of Hey Kids Comics. This is 288. Cole, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight we're going to talk about how damn close we are to 300 issues.
All right. We're going to make it.
We're going to make it and we're going to break it. We are talking tonight about a maverick company, pun intended, that emerged at just the right time to become uniquely positioned in the comic industry.
Yeah, yeah. And not only and yes, uniquely positioned, but not only that, stalwart in their attrition.
Yes.
They've lasted. They've maintained for so long because of really interesting, smart ideas that no one else is willing to do. It's very cool. It's a very cool thing.
Absolutely. We're of course talking about Dark Horse Comics, founded in 1986 by Mike Richardson, who, if you ever see this man interviewed, he just, it's like, wait, don't turn off the camera. There's so much more he can tell us. We are ready for your wisdom, Mike Richardson.
I love that. During the research for this, I was finding all these interviews with Mike, and they were like, so like the Ditko interview that we covered in our quarterly,
yes,
that's going to come out was like, you know, a page, you know, it was a page, you know, you might read like Cup of Joe with Joe Quesada, and it's like a page. Richardson's got like volumes of just, he'll just go, and it's all great, but he'll just talk forever. So if you ever need research for this kind of show, he's on it. Don't worry, he's got it under control.
Yeah, he's certainly, what's fascinating is that he starts out opening a comic shop.
Yes.
In Bend, Oregon.
Yes, he does.
Which is all left turns, by the way. That's how it got its name.
Damn it.
There's no right.
I don't like it.
But, you know, here he is at the retail level. So he's seeing what's out there on the market. And he's like that Ren and Stimpy horse. No, sir. Don't like it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. He's in a prime position to know what works and what doesn't. But he's also got that ballsy American pioneer spirit that you can only get, you know, taking the... This might be, we should have titled this like the Ladder Oregon Trail, because that's essentially what it
was.
Wow. Yeah, it was this pioneer spirit to say, yeah, everybody else is scared to do what I'm about to do, but screw it, I'm going to do it.
Absolutely. And and I think maybe we should call this horse of a different color, or the Oregon Tail.
Oh, see? That's how you work a writer's room, ladies and gentlemen. You throw an idea out there, and your team punches it up.
That's right.
I love it. I love it. So how does this go down? How does this start? How does this work? So he opens his comic shop, what, in, God, I don't know, the 80s, the early 80s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, about 1980, I believe, from what I've read.
So he opens this
shop called Pegasus Books.
Hangs out for like 6 years, selling comics, having a good time. I don't know how many other locations, but you're led to believe that he has at least two or three.
Yeah, it sounded like it went from a single store operation to more stores.
Yeah, just we'll call it more stores. And, you know, through his retail experience, he starts to realize that there's a need, a call, and it's probably, honestly, because we're talking about the indie boom during this time period.
Yeah, this is actually the the beginning of the indie boom. And what's interesting about the indie boom is it's sort of like a string of bad fireworks.
It's like Christmas lights.
In that you have a boom, and then you have this kind of a string of fizzling. You know, there's a period where it just kind of cools off, and then you get another boom in the 90s. And you get a much bigger boom in the 90s than you had in the late 80s. Especially when, you know, Dark Horse becomes this wonderful proof of concept, but gets eclipsed by Image as proof of concept.
Right, which is not fair. But to Dark Horse's credit, they threw up their middle fingers in the air and said, guess what? We're not going anywhere. We're going to make this damn thing work. By hook or by crook, you sons of bitches.
Well, and in many ways, I think that what sets Richardson and Dark Horse apart is Richardson's coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
He isn't a collection of hot young artists.
Yeah, he isn't in a Calvin Klein ad.
Or, yeah.
What was it? Lee? I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't invited to appear on Bob.
Right.
I'll let people figure out what I'm talking about there. But, you know, before Image, he was doing what Image did as a guy who owned a comic shop.
Yeah.
Which effectively to the comic reading audience of its day, and certainly to the 90s people who flocked around Image, this was just some ordinary guy doing what he wanted, giving comics, the industry, what its readers had wanted. And what's really interesting is I didn't realize that he starts out the company with two publications, Boris the Bear.
Where's Eddie when you need him?
Yeah, which Eddie just loves Boris the Bear. And I actually owned a copy of the first issue of Boris the Bear because I couldn't pass up this sort of Rambo Punisher teddy bear guy.
Mm-hmm.
With a cover that said, Boris the Bear slaughters the teenage radioactive black belt mutant ninja critters. And not a moment too soon. Because they were the spearhead of that first indie boom.
The teenage tenacious Ninja Turtles.
And,
yeah.
And everything that followed, all the wannabes, all the lookalikes. Which, you know, to give it a Rancor pit twist, is kind of like all the wannabe movies that came out after Star Wars.
Well, and I think
it's a natural progression.
But I think more so, I agree with you, right? But keep in mind, this guy ran a comic book shop for a long time. Cole, you've done it, right? It's been a dream of mine to do it. Seeing books like TMNT come, seeing books like Flaming Carrot come, seeing these books that should be more popular, they know they should be more popular, but you're only getting one issue a week, and watching X-Men, you know, whatever, fly off the shelves, and trying to do your dead level best to preach how great these other books are, getting no traction. I think putting them in that book, Boris the Bear, was as much a doff of the cap as it was, you know, a skewering, saying, hey, this is how you know, thank you for paving the way, and this is how you know we've made it, you
but
know?
What was interesting with Boris the Bear is that it didn't stop. There were so many parodies in that day. In fact, somewhere in like 2021, somewhere between 2019 and 2021, we have an issue coming up called Roasted. And there was a lot of parody going on as well.
Right.
And Boris the Bear could have just been another damned parody book. But they got their parody out of their system and went on to tell tales about Boris the Bear. And I think that's what set it apart is, you know, you get that initial hook, and then people realize, oh, this is a good book. It was worth, you know, continuing. And then Dark Horse Presents gave comics something they hadn't had in a long time, and that was the anthology.
Yep.
Or to put it in a perspective, for some of you may remember books like Heavy Metal or the short-lived 1984, which was actually published in about 1979 or 80, and they realized 1984 was getting damned close. So they changed the name to 1994.
Yeah, or they could have just not given a shit about it, like another anthology, 2018.
Yes, exactly. And the thing about the anthology was, in this these types of examples, is they weren't just a collection of stories and that was the end of it. You would get serialized stories. So in many ways, that's a gamble because you're forcing people who want to follow one or two of the titles mm-hmm. to follow all of them.
Right.
And ideally, perhaps discover something unexpected. The same was true of England's Warrior magazine, where both Miracle Man and V for Vendetta began.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think it's important to mention, even now at the start, that Dark Horse is starting to ramp up. See, he creates his own comic company. But from the get-go, and this is something that we talk about often. I know Cole has some things coming up that he wants to talk about with this in some future episodes. But the only comic company that had an eye on creator rights at the time that was going to make an impact. They set out to say, we're going to protect our creators. We're going to let you own your material. We are going to give you a place to put it and probably charge you a fee, but it's yours. So walk away with it if you want. Do whatever you want, whatever's within your contract, but we're not taking that from you.
That's right. You're not going to be creating what in many cases would become some of the most iconic characters in independent comics. We're not just going to make you a grist mill for our own profits. So, you know, Dark Horse has that connection. They probably get, I would imagine there must be something in the contract where they were able to get at least some residual off of having provided that platform when the licensing truck comes around. But if you look at things like The Mask and Hellboy,
mm-hmm.
both of which have had at least two cinematic incarnations.
Concrete.
Which sadly has never been adapted.
But it was so good.
Paul Chadwick is one of the most incredible writer artists in comics because he's a writer first and who just happens to be an insanely good artist. And he crafts incredibly intricate tales that utilize and humanize the sole superhuman character in the narrative.
Yeah, for sure. Like they've done amazing work because they allow the creators to do amazing work. And watching again that kind of tentpole set up in a comic shop and watching it all go down and watching people, I don't know if abused is the right word, but whatever the right word is for what happens to comic creators, and watching it happen and saying, not here, not going to happen here, is an amazing, and being successful, showing people that your way works, shows a tenacity that is pretty amazing. Also, The Mask was a great comic, and I love Jim Carrey, but he absolutely did not do it justice.
Well, and the thing about it is that Dark Horse Presents becomes kind of the springboard. That and the success of these early titles open the door for them to have venture capital to then go to the studios and say, you know, hey, we'd like to do comics based on the Alien franchise.
Yeah.
And you know, much later, some other characters like Predator and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Star Wars eventually.
I mean,
they began to get a reputation not only for buying the license, but for respecting what their purchase.
Yeah. Yeah.
They told tales that, you know, you've heard me gush about Aliens versus Predator. That was a damn movie in graphic novel, in a graphic fiction format. It could have just gone straight to the screen and been a very good film.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And because
it should
of
have
that,
been.
And because of that, and I know we touched on it a little bit, they started to attract major talent.
Yes.
Because major talent isn't allowed to do what major talent should do, which is develop their own ideas. They're forced to write, you know, another issue of Superman. So you get guys like John Byrne showing up on the scene doing Next Men, which is fan-damn-tastic. You get Matt Wagner doing Grendel. You start getting these guys coming out of the woodwork, and you get guys
Mike
like
Mignola
Bob Burton. Oh, God, Mike Mignola. Good Lord, that man.
You have to, because if memory serves, I think I read somewhere that Hellboy's Origins was a contract cover for a comic convention program. It was just a character used to kind of illustrate the cover of a program book for some convention.
So it was just the cover art for a convention fly,
yeah,
like convention program.
A what for Mignola might have been a generic character.
Right, just somebody he whipped up.
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, in that image, he has a belt buckle that says Hellboy on it.
Can we find that image? I need to see if I can find that image. Let me see if
yeah.
I can find it.
I was hoping I'd spot something on that while I was talking about it, but I remember reading an article about it, and that's what sits at the back of my mind, even though I can't necessarily back that up at the moment.
But that's yep, I found it here. I'm gonna throw it up in the Skyperson so that you can see the fruits of your labor, Cole. There it goes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Different character altogether, different style from Mike Mignola, but absolutely there.
You can certainly say that it is the genesis of the character.
And I think...
Yes, indeed. That's
I think
the one
of the coolest things about Dark Horse is that there are a lot of things that are out there that you don't get, that you don't know are Dark Horse. Things that would shock you to know that are Dark Horse. Like, I didn't even know. Now, I knew this one, but Mystery Men was Dark Horse.
I did not realize that. Yes, I did not realize that Mystery Men, we started seeing some iconography for the film, and Manticore writer Frank Anderson was just gushing, like, Mystery Men, Mystery Men. We're like, what in the hell? And we would find out that it was actually based on a comic, not just a movie that was about comic-type characters.
Now, keep in mind, it didn't start at Dark Horse, but it ended there because that's where, you know, you give the artist the ability to do what they want and money to do it. They'll come there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's just awesome. It's just awesome.
Well, in many ways, and not to reduce the impact.
Oh, no.
But in many ways, it was sort of like Roger Corman Studios. It was a springboard where you could succeed or fail on your own terms.
Listen, bringing up Roger Corman Studios around me will never reduce the impact. All right? Roger Corman is a god man.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but he did within his means whatever was possible. And I think in many ways, that's what happens with Dark Horse. Is it allowed people, because, you know, Mignola couldn't have sold that to anybody else.
No, and he probably tried, or similar ideas.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm doing this, I'm doing some work for you on Batman, but I really got this idea for a thing that I think would work. Nope, under no circumstances are we doing that. All right, look at John Byrne. Who had more name recognition in the early 90s than John Byrne?
Exactly.
And you can't, and you won't buy John Byrne's idea? Like, you assholes. You literal assholes. Like, so he took his idea over to Dark Horse. Like,
well, apparently I did find where he pitched it to the board of directors at DC Comics.
Oh, really?
And they loved the idea and decided that they really didn't want anything to do with Hell. Though, what is this, like 80-some-odd?
Yeah, it would have been...
Though in the 90s, they had a full-fledged demon comic book.
Oh, yeah.
Ephraim got his own title, Hellblazer. I mean, I think in many ways, we got the demon, we got Hellblazer, we got a lot of stuff, because they were like, you know, we should have done that Hellboy.
We should have picked up that Hellboy. But what's really funny about that is in another... Okay, so before we do that, can we talk, because I know you're going to be able to talk about this much better than I will. Can we speak to the effect that the dovetail of the direct market had on Dark Horse?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Dark Horse, as a comic shop owner, Richardson, or he's almost like a couple of things happened during the, you know, the 80s, I guess would be the appropriate way to look at this. And it had a lot to do with comic book retailers.
Okay.
And if you have to bear with me a moment, because I want to get my timing just right.
Well, while you're getting your timing right, you lived this, though.
Oh, very much so. I lived in the direct market. So
literally some nights, probably.
Only a few years earlier did a former postman in Baltimore, Maryland, turned comic shop owner, decided that there had to be a better way. And the direct market, in a sense, was in its infancy.
What was – so I – what – yeah, it's going to be a stupid question, but you're going to know the answer. What was the way prior to the direct market that comic shops got their comics? Because now we think about Wednesdays, bright and early, UPS shows up.
On how Wednesday became comic book day.
Oh, don't start that. We've talked about
that's
that.
That's a whole other tale there.
Good. Friday, no. Nope, Thursday, no. Nope, Wednesday.
Oh, yeah. When Wednesday became rather well cemented, there were still rumblings of, you know, Tuesday would be better.
Yeah, they aren't getting there. People are really wanting these books on Tuesday.
Yeah, and it's like, no, because this week's comics are coming out the week before.
Right.
You know, it doesn't work that way.
You can't reinvent the Roman calendar to make your comics better.
You know, can we put it like a day that comes before Sunday?
Can we invent a new day for this?
Yeah, called Com Day. But the thing about it is that prior to the direct market, comic books in general, I mean, the idea of a comic shop kind of emerged. I'm not really sure of the origins of the actual direct market because it predates the boom of the direct market.
Okay.
There was a direct market that emerged somehow. I'm not sure how the distribution worked. But prior to that, you know, you're old enough to remember that there was a time when the 7-Eleven was your comic book shop.
Oh, yeah, you got grocery
store. You would have people who would come in every month. They'd take away whatever didn't sell and destroy it.
Yeah, how much was destroyed? We need a figure on that.
They would take magazines, comics, what have you. You would be invoiced for what's sold, and then they would bring in fresh material every single month. And that, I think, there were comic shops. There were shops that sold back issue comics. I think there were people who were buying comic books and reselling them. And from that, you began to find, you know, bookstores and the emergent comic book store that wanted, here I'm going to be speculating a bit, that wanted to have better access. And the publishers found a way. And to distinguish that product from the product of the rack jobber, I guess, presumably so someone, some rabid rack jobber didn't come and steal your comics that you paid for. I remember some of the earliest issues of Star Wars that I had a little, instead of the numbering being in a square box at the top, it was in a little diamond-shaped thing.
Really? Oh, no, yes.
Yeah, if you ever saw early comics, like if you're old enough to remember when, like, you know, sometimes you go and find like a bagged set of comics, like, you know, the first three issues of Star Wars or something in a bag, they would have that diamond shape.
Yeah, I remember that. I do.
And that is where one Steve Jeppy, comic shop owner, decided he would start a kind of a comic shop friendly distribution network and named it Diamond Comic Distributors.
Really?
And we have our third quarterly, Hey Kids Comics Quarterly, we're going to talk about the way that Diamond became the accidental monopoly that they are today.
Yeah, because I am really interested. You know, that's not what this show's about. I just want to talk about how, you know, how effective it was, the timing,
Yes, exactly. So Diamond Comics Distributors gets founded in 1982.
Right.
So as a comic book retailer, the direct market exists in a very real and substantial way by the time Dark Horse Comics emerges.
Right.
So the timing was ideal.
Yeah, it was the perfect storm.
So you had a couple of years for the thing to get its legs under it. And by then, undoubtedly, everybody else was emerging. Friendly Franks and Capital City and hundreds of regionals that over a great number of decades just got swallowed up by Friendly Franks and Diamond and, and Capital City. And I remember in our Diamond years, there was a someone had found an ad for something and cut out the part where it says, you know, there's a place for businesses like yours, and they just put the Capital City logo.
Oh, God. That's funny.
I could tell many a tale.
Good.
About
you're going
my Diamond
to.
Years.
You're going
one of these
to.
Days, we're just going to have to do a Diamond Comic Distributors episode.
Maybe the fourth quarterly.
Maybe. Or maybe our first 90-minute giant, because God knows I could talk for 90 minutes
it's
about
done.
That.
It's done. Done deal.
All right. 90-minute giant number one.
90-minute giant number one. The
rough
diamond.
In the diamond.
Yep. All right, cool. So let's get back to Dark Horse.
Yeah.
So what we found ourselves with was a perfect storm. Dark Horse had the distribution network using direct market. Dark Horse had the talent that they were attracting because of the fact that they were protecting owner rights. Then Dark Horse did something really interesting. And that was they decided they were going to print their own money.
Pretty much.
And how did they print their own money? They started licensing a whole bunch of stuff and putting it out. Like you said, in very smart, very unique ways, they were putting out all manner of licensed materials. I was surprised to find out that Time Cop...
Oh, wow.
Jean-Claude Van Damme's Time Cop...
This is my favorite movie.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me, oh God, what's his name?
I know, I'm drawing a blank.
If you haven't watched Jean-Claude Van Johnson, do yourself the favor and watch The Son of a Bitch, because it's brilliant.
Yeah, he said that Looper was his favorite movie.
That Philippe, can't be possible.
Philippe. It's Philippe.
Philippe, it's Philippe. I love Philippe.
Philippe, man, that show is just fantastic. But Time Cop, oddly enough, Dark Horse. So they would just take these. You know, you're going to sell a comic book based on.
Quick aside.
What's that?
Let's take a quick aside.
Okay.
Because Time Cop is based on a Dark Horse comic, apparently.
Yeah.
I knew movies like Tank Girl.
Yep.
The Mask.
Yep.
The Rocketeer.
Mm-hmm.
Virus.
Yes. Oddly enough, yes. Weirdly enough, yes.
American Splendor.
Barbed Wire.
Oh, God. We'll touch more on Barbed Wire in a little bit. Of course, Sin City published by, initially by Dark Horse. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it yet, track down the TV pilot from 2006 of Amazing Screw-On-Head.
Oh, God, it's so good.
It is downright brilliant stuff. 300, for example. But a lot of these are films by studios that were picking up either the license of Dark Horse-owned comics or the license from the creator owners.
Yes, yes.
Then there's a movie that... to my knowledge, was not based on any comic per se, though it may well have been based on a comic. But in the 90s, let's see here, that would have been somewhere in the neighborhood of when were they just going? I mean, they were so flush with capital.
Yeah.
This would have been about mid to late 90s, probably somewhere in 94, 95, something like that. In fact, I could probably... pinpoint it exactly if I had my wits about me. It's like The Rocketeer was actually produced by Disney, but
Chris Columbus.
There's a little movie starring Larry Drake of Darkman fame and whatever the hell show he was on where he actually got famous.
Oh, I know where you're going. Yep.
And I remember this movie very well. I've never seen it. Have no desire to see it. It was released. Oh my gosh, we're nearly coming up on the anniversary on October 23rd, 1992.
Holy cow! Okay.
Produced by none other than Dark Horse Studios.
It's direct from Dark Horse Studios.
Yes, their first feature film. This actually got a theatrical release, and for years they. Goddamn poster that Dark Horse sent us hung Paul at Diamond.
They sent you a poster? It wasn't even a comic book movie.
No, but it was their movie. They put the money up for it.
Sure.
It was their first outing of Dark Horse Studios, and to this day, I still have this sort of like mental earworm thing going on with a goddamn tagline. If you're from Morhai and you get sick, fall on your knees and pray you die quick. That was the slogan.
Well, they did their job. You remember it.
Dr. Giggles.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I can't find any reference. Now, I think there have been comics since, but this is just a completely original. Somebody had an idea. They wanted to apply these same principles that they were using for comic books to movies. Like, oh yeah, you got an idea? All right, yeah, we'll give you some. We'll produce that shit for you.
Yeah,
like this crazy shit.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I never really went beyond what else Dark Horse Entertainment had ever produced, but that was.
Now I'm curious. You keep going.
That was definitely one of them, and it's hard to find good. Good specifics on this because there's so much stuff that's based on properties that started at Dark Horse or landed at Dark Horse that when you go trying to find Dark Horse's cinematic stuff, there's stuff that Dark Horse Studios didn't or Dark Horse Entertainment didn't produce, but you'll find it on lists. So it's been very difficult to try to track down any kind of hard evidence. But boy, did they tell us all about Dr. Giggles.
So how did this Dr. Giggles thing go down for you guys? Because you were at Diamond.
Yeah.
Dr. Giggles is...
Dark Horse just gifted us the actual one sheet.
Like, it has nothing to do with the comic book.
And there was a press release
that
we got. Yeah. They were just really proud of the fact that they were now venturing off into movies.
I'm just so enamored by the idea of this.
Oh, I know, isn't it? But because it is actually really wonderful that they had that kind of dough.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, because they also produced My Name is Bruce in 2007.
They produced My Name is Bruce?
Yes, the Bruce Campbell film, My Name is Bruce.
I was thinking They Call Me Bruce.
Oh, no.
Oh, thank God, yes.
No, the Bruce Campbell...
Yes.
Like action
comedy.
Oh,
they loved Bruce Campbell. I think Bruce Campbell loved them.
Oh, I'm sure. Because you've also got to figure the unique personality that goes into doing something like this. Because you can't you're not Wall Street Maven that turns into this, that produces, that makes this a dream, that becomes a reality. It takes a wild, crazy... Almost like if you go out and you watch, and Cole, I know Cole's watched it, the Funko documentary.
Oh, yes.
Almost the same vein as that, where it takes...
Very much like, I had not made that connection, but it has that same sort of feel of just somebody doing something for themselves, and everything else falls into place behind it.
Yeah, it takes a certain tenacity to... You know, use the chaos magic and your force of will to create a comic publisher that survives. And I think that the reason that either... I don't think it's the reason that so many don't, but I think the reason that this one absolutely did was that he could get people to buy into his vision.
Yes.
If not to give him capital to say, yeah, let's do my book. Let's give it a shot. Let's see what happens. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, that's what makes an amazing comic. That's what lays the groundwork for Image, to be able to be Image. That's, you know, this isn't a, you know, we did the entire episode on TMNT, Mirage Studios, what that was.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a fake it till you make it, and God bless those two for doing it.
Oh, yeah.
That was an amazing story in and of itself, but this isn't a fake it till you make it. This is a, we know that the odds are stacked against us, and we're still going in to do it. Every day could be the day they turn the lights off, but we don't give a shit. Exactly. I want to see a documentary on Dark Horse.
That would be fascinating to see.
Yeah, I want to see that. So what else you got here,
because,
Cole?
Like, the first 90 minutes is just him talking.
Oh, that's the whole documentary. They actually just have to run footage.
They just set up a camera and leave.
So, like, I would like to get into some of these titles now.
Okay, well, we mentioned Concrete, and I honestly, I can't say enough good about Concrete. I've not read any of the early stuff, but the wonderful thing about Chadwick is he presents you this character you can walk into already, you know, already in progress.
Yeah.
It's a very approachable character because there's enough subtext without, you know, shoving everything down your throat or anything like that, or reiterating constantly to the point where you feel like, what am I watching, another damn relaunch of Batman where we have to find out how he became Batman?
Right.
So what you get is some of just amazing tales, and there are two that I would cite because they happened before he got really preachy.
Okay.
Some of the later ones, like I can't remember the names of them now. They're good, but they do get a little preachy. But essentially, let me lay the groundwork. Is Concrete's a story about an ordinary guy who gets abducted by aliens and has his consciousness transferred into the body of the Fantastic Four's The Thing, if you erased all the rocks.
Yes. Yes.
He's like the Brazilian Thing.
God damn. I can't with you tonight. Yeah, I was gonna say he's kind of the thing that you want to read.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's thing, and then there's the thing you actually want to be a part of.
And what's really cool about it is Chadwick presents this character who has been imbued with superhuman size and strength and invulnerability, and gets into these just kind of quirky adventures as a result. So it's a very grounded, real world, what if kind of story. And I believe one of the early short stories that probably appeared in Dark Horse Presents was where he was hired as the bodyguard for some nihilistic rock star who would go on stage with loaded pistols taped to his body and long strings depending from the triggers.
Really?
And Concrete's sole job was to keep his fan base from
killing him.
Finishing the job, yeah. See, just to kind of illustrate, but there were the two that I would cite as some of the best comics I've ever read, and I probably talked about at least one of these, are Concrete Fragile Creature, which has amazing insight into the film industry and takes a rather playful look at what it might have been like for the production of Masters of the Universe.
Oh, really?
Because it's basically about the film industry and posits the idea that a film production is a fragile creature. And all of the trials and tribulations of this toy-based movie that feels a hell of a lot like Masters of the Universe, if Tim Burton was directing.
Oh, that's cool.
And the other is Concrete Killer Smile, which to this day is Watchmen level good.
Okay, so I need to check that out. Okay.
And it is the story of his friend and chronicler basically crossing paths with the Natural Born Killers kind of story.
Okay.
And it's just a very human tale, and in the end, one of the best uses of a character of this type. The closing dialogue is just blows me. I mean, I'm actually getting like tingling.
Yeah, and I can tell.
Remembering how brilliant and like, yes, that is exactly what someone would do if they were concrete.
If they were concrete.
If they were.
So I need to read that. Also, I've been an asshole and remiss, and Cole's been suggesting on this show and in my personal life for me to read Starman by James Robinson for, God, I don't know, 8 years? Some god-awful amount of time, and I finally read it, and it is astounding. It has nothing to do with Dark Horse, but it is astounding.
But it has everything to do with astounding.
It's right. I just wanted to make that clear.
And of course, you know, as I mentioned, you've heard me gush about Aliens versus Predator.
Well, let's talk. I mean, we've got, I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time here.
Yeah.
But we've got a pretty substantial Dark Horse issue coming up in 12 weeks.
Yes, indeed.
Like a very substantial issue on 300 in 12 weeks. Keep in mind how crazy it is that the guy that wrote, or the guy that reinvented Batman, the guy that reinvented Daredevil, because that was before Sin City, right? I'm not crazy. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're not wrong.
Yeah, that was before 300. Then went over to, after all of that, with these two, with the two bigs, the two gigantic publishing houses, had to then go over to Dark Horse to get his own thing done.
Yeah.
That's nuts to me. That's crazy pants. But he did it. Because Frank Miller's insane. But he did it.
Well, the thing about it is, I think the other thing, the other perfect, another aspect of this perfect storm.
Okay.
Is that Dark Horse not only provides this kind of safe harbor, this place where things that would never be all elsewhere are starting to happen, but it also becomes the sole venue for these things to happen until Image comes along and starts opening their doors, like, hey, you know, you can come publish under our imprint. Like the a great example would be the webcomic PvP or Player versus Player.
Right.
But, and then, you know, little by little, a lot, there were some titles that were at Dark Horse that eventually went over to Image. That's because, true. Frankly, Image was an even bigger footprint. But
it
that
was sexier. Let's put it that
yeah,
way.
That's true. But the thing is, prior to that, this was the only place some of this stuff, you could be a John Byrne or a Frank Miller or, you know, God forbid, an Image partner.
Right.
And I think there are probably even projects that just weren't a good fit. If you were like, if Todd McFarlane got a wild hair up his ass and came up with something that might have actually been good, that might not have felt like a good fit at Image. I mean, nowadays, the way Image opened themselves up to being another bigger Dark Horse, that is no longer the case. But I think the other thing is they're just things that wouldn't fit. 300 couldn't find a fit.
Yeah.
Because at the time 300 was released, nobody was doing Marvel and DC both at different times have had a place to park things that don't fit in the DCU.
And that's Vertigo, right?
Yeah, Vertigo for DC. There were a couple of different imprints at Marvel. Max was one, if I remember correctly. And there was another that predated that escapes me at the moment. But you know, every once in a while, they would have these sort of oft-ignored secondary imprints.
Right.
DC also had Paradox Press, which published in an awkward micro Reader's Digest size formatting.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's where, what is it? Well, two films came out of Paradox Press titles. The one with Viggo Mortensen and the one with Jude Law. I'll think of the names of either of the
History
damn
of Violence and
History of Violence.
I thought that History of Violence and
Was it Road to Purgatory? Or?
Yeah, that one. Yes, yeah, Road to Perdition with Tom Hanks and Jude Law, right?
Yeah,
Road to Perdition. But I thought that both of those Viggo Mortensen movies were both based on comics. History of Violence and what was the other one he did? The other, like, the one where he was the Russian mobster with all the tattoos.
Oh man, that's
I can't
not
remember.
Seen that.
Whatever, it's fine. He was naked.
But the thing about it is that
Russian bathroom.
Only at intervals were there any places you could take the material, no matter how famous you were. I mean, God himself could hand down a script and be like, this is great, but where do we put it in the DCU?
Right. But hasn't
that
long
God
been the failing?
Dark Horse Comics.
Hasn't that long been the failing of DC or Marvel? That who knows what amazing titles or amazing licenses or IPs or ideas are out there that they're going to shun because it doesn't fit into, quote-unquote, their universe?
But the practical offshoot of that is, in the context of Dark Horse, you had this opportunity arise that didn't exist before to show them exactly
right
what they were missing.
Right.
But even then, they're in a position to fail miserably at this and still crush their enemies, see them driven before them, and hear the lamentations of the women.
That's true. So I wonder how much this is... Yeah, take...
They don't care because they don't have to care.
Yeah, just take your idea over. Hey, why don't you take that idea over to Dark Horse? You can get it published over there, but continue to do The Flash.
Yeah, you know? You're going to continue to make us money and get nothing out of it, and then your little pet projects could turn into a major feature film for all we know or care.
Right. We don't care.
But it's not like Paramount and Columbia Pictures lamenting, telling George Lucas to take a hike. It's not like Mattel saying, why would we want to do a license on a movie that's only good for 6 months?
Right.
You know, they live or die by these things.
Yeah.
Marvel and DC, if a a creator-owned something goes off like wildfire, they're like, no, that's great.
Just like,
oh, hang on. Beep, beep, beep. Here comes the money truck.
Yeah.
Sorry. You were saying?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over Batman.
I couldn't hear you over the money counting machine.
Well, let's leave this room with a bunch of naked people counting my money.
That's right.
I can't hear you over the nakedness of these people counting my money. Oh, my God. Yeah, no,
I don't have naked people counting my money because I can afford to.
That's right. I don't want their dirty clothes touching my fresh money. But, yeah, so I think you're absolutely right. And the thing about DC or Dark Horse is they're no sign of letting up. Keep right on trucking, keep going, and they set the precedent for so many other publishers now. They set the precedent for Image. They set the precedent for Boom. They set the precedent for Dynamite. They set the precedent that you can do this and be successful at it. And, you know, that's amazing. Good for them. Because
oh, absolutely. I think the bottom line is if you do good work, if you create a good product, the market comes to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
Granted, it's a very limited one.
But, I mean, they even did manga.
Yes.
They did, you know, they were taking shots. They did, you know, they had an imprint where they would import manga and print it for the American audience, which, keep in mind, at the time, you couldn't just go to Barnes & Noble and buy it. That
yeah.
wasn't happening. This is how you got it. You know, like Akira and Astro Boy and Ghost in the Shell, Lone Wolf and Cub. You know, all of those. Dark Horse was the distributor. I guess not the distributor, but the house that published those. So you got a lot of... you got a lot of homage to give to Dark Horse, regardless of what you're a fan of.
Well, and let's take a moment to talk about, I'd mentioned sort of in passing without really thinking about the connotation of the connection per se. You have Dark Horse having this sort of, you know, throwing things out there and allowing them to succeed or fail.
Right.
And one was one example that's kind of hit and miss was an imprint known as Comics Greatest World.
Okay.
Comics Greatest World, to my surprise, survived 3 full years. But it was a line where they were going to create their own superhero universe.
Right.
Under the Comics Greatest World imprint. And most of it wasn't that great, to be quite frank. I don't know if they were all creator-owned, but in the way a lot of this stuff is, it's kind of a disjointed universe. But it did have 2 distinct successes amid its many failures.
Okay.
What was it, like District something? Or what was the name of that title? It was, they had like a group book.
I don't remember.
There was like one group called Pit Bulls.
I remember that. I do remember that. I remember the other one that was the successful one that you're going to talk about, though.
But, and there was Motorhead.
I remember Motorhead.
Was part of the original. And it was sort of broken up into different areas. Division 13 was the one I was trying to think of. Hero Zero.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Were among some of the early titles. And they went all in, like these retail promo Chrome editions of the first issues and great big, you know, packaged retailer blitzes and all this stuff. And but the 2 that succeeded, in my opinion, or, you know, seemed to thrive where the others kind of were very hit and miss, was one called Ghost.
Yep.
Which lasted, I think, the entire run of
they're making a movie.
Are they?
Mm-hmm. I think it's like a Netflix. I think it's like, and that's another cool thing, is things like Dark Horse allowed things like Stranger Things to exist.
Yes, that's so true. And in many ways,
yeah,
you know, the advent of like the streaming services producing their own stuff becomes much like, you know, Stranger Things would never have existed on regular television. And
exactly.
And regular television, unlike Marvel and DC, is probably kicking themselves for not considering
now. Now, yeah, in hindsight.
But the other that strangely enough became popular and garnered a proper film was Barb Wire.
Oh. God, Steel City, Steel Harbor,
Steel Harbor. That's right. Yeah, there were like different. The Comics Greatest World was apparently broken up into several different geographic regions or environments. There was Arcadia, Golden City, Steel Harbor, the Vortex, and I think I pretty much tapped out there.
Yeah, I think that was it, wasn't it? Golden City,
yeah.
Steel Harbor, Arcadia, and you said the Vortex, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, different characters operated within those you know, that was their main, like, Barbed Wire, Motorhead, and The Machine were all those
Dinsians.
Titles took place in Steel Harbor. Golden City had the titles like Titan and Catalyst, Agents of Change.
They were like Metropolis or Gotham or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arcadia had X, Ghost, and... but it just, for all of its bluster and all of this massive marketing machine, I think this was... That, in many ways, was the big mistake, is they just tried too hard.
Yeah.
And this may have been about the same time that Techno Comics was coming on the scene with, and, you know, marketing blitzes were huge.
I can't wait for that issue, by the way.
Oh, yeah, we do have an upcoming issue called Islands in the Mall, where we talk about Techno Comics and their attempt to be a publisher and a retailer.
Yeah, I love it. I literally cannot wait for that. Like, that's...
That is a very important blip on the radar screen of comic book history that I think, but for this show, might go unnoticed.
Yeah,
and if Catherine's up to it, we'll try to get her to join us because she actually managed a techno kiosk.
Well, I was also going to say that, right? Like, but for the 30 people that ever worked for them, you weren't going to get, you're not going to get the answer, you know? Like,
yeah.
Oh man, yeah.
McSplain ain't talking.
We need to start. We need to start wrapping this sucker up. So what? Got any final thoughts on Dark Horse? I think we did a pretty solid job of.
Oh, I believe you're right. The like so many of the topics that we try to tackle in a single issue, and you know that don't warrant a full arc. This is there's so much to tell. But I think we covered all of the principal bases. I definitely had to bring Dr. Giggles into the mix.
Oh,
about this perfect timing, this world in which Dark Horse arrived precisely when it needed to.
Oh, it was perfect.
Sort of like Gandalf, you know, the wizard who arrives precisely when he isn't supposed to.
It was the perfect timing. Like, it couldn't have been better. For that to all the stars aligned so that it could hit just perfectly. And I love Dark Horse, and I love what Dark Horse has done. I love what they're capable of, and they keep doing it too. I think that that's...
Yes. Well, I mean, they took the reins of Star Wars, for example, and wrote it beautifully for...
Oh, we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, and you know, I think solely the arrival of, you know, Disney purchasing Lucasfilm and owning Marvel, where that went was a fairly obvious no-brainer. I mean, if you didn't see that coming, something seriously wrong. But during their tenure, they started out in one era and really developed that, and then little by little introduced more and more and expanded and continued to grow that license, and then brought us things like Star Wars Dark Empire, which is an iconic tale of the expanded universe, now no more.
Well, who did Shadows of the Empire, Cole? Who did that one?
They adapted Shadows of the Empire.
They adapted Shadows of the Empire. They adapted Shadows of the
Empire. They were part of the Shadows of the Empire marketing blitz.
So they sort of produced like the comics for Shadows of the Empire, the superior Star Wars story, above all others? Is that what we're saying?
They were part of the novel, soundtrack, comic, statue, PVC figure, action figure.
Toys, yeah.
Marketing blitz. Oh, and audio.
You guys need to do that Shadows of the... Because it's almost unprecedented.
Well, in fact, we met a guy, just to kind of tip my hand a little bit, we met a guy, or I did, at Holocron Toys Grand Opening, who was set up there with all the Shadows of the Empire stuff, practically anything that was ever made, just shy of one or two things, and he was working with a group trying to make an action figure animated
Shadows of the Empire
adaptation of Shadows of the Empire. And I told him that I thought I still had a Titanium Series Houndstooth Bossk ship, which would have been like one of the only things he didn't have a representation of.
Right.
And I reached out to him about, you know, I would love to have him on the Rancor Pit Live to talk about Shadows of the Empire, as someone who obviously is very much into it.
Yeah.
But never heard anything back, so I'm going to have to try to see if I can figure out who he was through Holocron.
But they did bring us... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, they were able to adapt to do the adaptation because they had the license at the time.
That just seems... That kind of media blitz shows a hubris, an unprecedented level of... I can't think of another movie franchise that, without a movie...
Yeah.
Decided that this was the blitz that they were going to take because they were in that middle distance between, you know, big events. So this, they were going to invent an event.
Absolutely, and it was a very shrewd move, but that is a tale unto itself, and we definitely need to give Shadow some love on the Rancor bit.
Oh, yeah.
And just in closing, I have to say that as publishers go, really not since Stan Lee talked his uncle into you know, letting him publish some book about some kid who dresses up in a Ben Cooper costume. No, check out the Hey Kids Comics Quarterly. That'll make sense.
Yeah, it will.
But, you know, some real-world kid getting superpowers and, you know, getting a begrudging green light for that.
Mm-hmm.
But really not since then was anyone so shrewd and so perfectly aware of the state of the market for comics.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, and handled it so adroitly for the last, God, 30 years. Or, yes. No, I guess 40 years now. And he says in an interview that went on for probably 8 hours, that he's, because of his love for comics and because of his, you know, having long boxes and collecting, and I actually wanted to ask Eddie, remind me to ask him, or if he's listening, Eddie, let me know.
Yes.
He says he collected every comic he could get his hands on, including recruitment comics that he picked up from the Air Force recruitment station. So I want to know if Eddie has any Air Force recruitment comics, because he collects those. But he said because of all of that, he probably thinks that a lot of his staff would like it a lot more if he was a lot more hands-off than he is. He's like, but that's never going to happen. He's like, I'm going to have my hand in every single thing until I literally can't anymore. So he's directly responsible, I think, for very much of their success. And that's awesome. I'm not to take away from anyone else, but, you know, his visionary nature, I think, is responsible for so much of their success.
Absolutely.
All right, let's wrap it up. Why don't you plug us up and we'll get out of here, man.
All right. Well, we're coming to you from the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. And as I often plug my other endeavors over at DallasOnAir.com, on the third Sunday of every month, I have my new show, Isle of Toys, where we talk about all kinds of different toys and collectibles, and that's the third Sunday of every month from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Central. The first and third Sundays of every month, good night, over 100 episodes later.
That's fantastic.
The Rantcore Pit Live, which has surpassed the original Rantcore Pit number of episodes. This is sad.
You just got to add them together at this point.
Oh, yeah, there's like damn near 200 episodes there. And that's with myself and Eddie Medina on the first and third Sundays every month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Central on DallasOnAir.com, streaming live from downtown Dallas.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You can find us at HK Comics Show on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. You know, I'm going to be posting some things asking for some audience participation here in the near future, so keep your eye on the prize, and I think Cole and I might be able to actually work up a real prize at some
point.
That's
true.
We might be doing something with that. So thank you all for listening and being a part of our little family here. We would not be doing this without somebody to listen to us. Otherwise, we would just turn the recording off, and it would just be Cole and I talking on a Thursday night.
That's right. We'd just be on the phone instead of on Skype.
Right.
And before we close everything up, I do want to encourage everybody, a little bit of shameless self-promotion here. If you'd like to help support the Jedi Cole Universe and the shows thereof and on DallasOnAir.com, I'm currently running auctions on eBay under Jedi Cole. We've had a lot of really cool stuff already come and go, but I'm getting ready to start doing something I haven't done in 10 years or more, and that's selling off some more of my collection of comic book promotional posters. And in fact, by the time this is airing, it'll probably be up among the auctions, unless it got bought on a really sweet offer or something. But I have a promotional piece. It's a little black and white piece from promoting The Black Pearl.
Oh.
A comic written by none other than Mark Hamill.
Interesting.
And it is a little fold-over promotional piece signed by Hamill and the artist, whose name escapes me at the moment.
That's fantastic, man.
It was sold in auction ages ago. And when I was rooting around the garage for stuff, I found the envelope where it and several other posters were ready to ship. The guy never paid, and I never took them out of the envelope. And I was very surprised to find that the Black Pearl
remains
was among those in that envelope.
Yeah, bid on that, guys. Come on. Yeah, that's awesome.
And that's a little piece of comic book history, and oddly enough, this is appropriate, as I thought, it was published by Dark Horse Comics.
There you go. Tie it back. Tie it back. Tie it back. Nice. I love it.
Signed by Mark Hamill and Eric Johnson, and we'll have that up here in the next few days to for your bidding pleasure.
There you go.
And each individual promo, or many of the individual promos, were personalized to a specific shop or right. comic tailor.
Oh man, that's cool.
And I think this one in question is long defunct. It was a company called Hank Supply.
I'm sure.
I think it Hank Supply died of Marvolution.
Yeah, which we'll be talking about in the near future.
Yeah.
All right, so head over Jedi Cole on eBay. I promise you a ton of great stuff over there.
Some great Eagle Moss Marvel and DC characters that still haven't been bought up. And if you're into old Dungeons & Dragons lead miniatures, I'm going to have a crap ton more of those coming.
Trying to get rid of those. All right, Cole. We're going to get out of here now.
All right. You need to get your sleep.
That's
and I need
right.
to,
we need to get our... We need to
get I need to get work on these damned auctions.
That's right. All right. So, enjoy your Dark Horse. If you're not familiar, get real familiar. If you are familiar, go back and read some. Like, I'm going to go back and find Concrete and read it because it sounds amazing. So, with all that being said, Cole, say goodnight.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. And join us next week for more of that Hey Kids Comics.